The Sangha is invited to return to our breathing so that our collective energy of mindfulness will bring us together as an organism, going as a river with no more separation. Let the whole Sangha breathe as one body, be free as one body, generate peace as one body. Let us transcend the boundaries of the delusive self, liberating from the superiority complex, the inferiority complex, and the equality complex.
Thank you for coming this morning. Mindfulness and concentration. That is the beginning, the middle, and the end. It is something that needs to perfume our lives so we can realize our potential for this life, and to really accomplish any goal that we really want to accomplish. Mindfulness gives us the capacity to be self-aware. It is very hard for us to change if we cannot see that which needs to be changed. So mindfulness is like a mirror. In the same way as it's very difficult to know what we look like, right? How our clothes are, how our clothes look, how our face look, how our hair looks, if we are not... This is my minder. It is very hard to change if we do not have an inner mirror, some way that we can look at ourselves and see objectively what's going on in our mind. So, mindfulness, while we begin with the body and the breath, to cultivate a calm and stableness within our body-mind. It is just the foundation. Because our happiness or our unhappiness is a condition of our minds, right? Whether we are cultivating and aware of ourselves as wholesome human beings with wholesome mind states, or whether we find that we cultivate a lot of unwholesomeness in our life. All this is going on in our minds. From our minds it spills out into our words, into our actions. But mind is the king, the queen. Mind king. And so we are, as a path, we are cultivating this mindfulness of body and breath and learning to stabilize and calm and clarify our mind. On the one hand, that has therapeutic value. It feels good, it's stable. It gives us a ground, it gives us an anchor in our life, which is most of us don't have. So we have some kind of anchor that prevents us from just being constantly swept around by external situations, by people, by our own internal emotions and feelings. But eventually we want to begin to change and transform this mind of ours, and which is primarily what the Buddhist teachings and practices ultimately point to. So that is mindfulness, you know, that capacity in the beginning. Can I be self-aware? Can I be objectively aware of what is arising in my mind? Right? Not only as an emotion or a feeling or a thought or a story, but even as a tendency. Something that's driving us along, even somewhat unknowingly. Can I stop and begin to have this mirror lit up within myself? And that will make it so much easier for us to transform. Now, this is the unfortunate thing. This is the thing that we often find frustrating. Because even though mindfulness is a natural capacity of our mind, it is one that we have lost capability in, right? Our minds are so filled with stuff. There's so many distractions and projections and filters that we have kind of been cultivating unknowingly in the course of our life. Our capacity to really see ourselves clearly is very limited and often very distorted. So we have to develop this competency. And unfortunately, this competency is something that is only developed by practice. And so we have this dilemma we're in. And if we're not careful, it can become a real obstacle. Is that, unfortunately, we have to practice where we're at, you see. And for many of us, that is a great disappointment, okay? Because we would love to be able to practice where we'd like to be at, where we'd hope to be at, where we think we should be at. Is that clear? You know, and this is a tough one that we need to hopefully resolve early on. It's sort of like, you know, that's my destination. That's where I want to get to in life. That's where I want to get to within my own maturity, we might say. That's my goal. It's good to have a goal and good to have a destination, but unfortunately, I'm here. Right? And that's the truth. I'm here. I want to get there, but I'm here. And so therefore, I cannot be anywhere else than here. Then therefore, I need to learn the skills that will get me from here to there. And that only can occur within the realm of practice. It cannot occur within the realm of reading. It cannot occur within the realm of study. It cannot occur within the realm of listening to talks. It cannot occur within the realm of talking about it with others. Even though those are kinds of waterings, right? They water those seeds. But it is only through this very consistent cultivation or caretaking of the actions of our body, speech, and mind, of meditation, that we really develop the ability to do just what I was saying, to develop self-awareness, to be able to see ourselves as we are. So mindfulness, in a very immediate way, we can enjoy quieting down, et cetera, and stabilizing through the learning how to meditate and learning some meditation, learning some mindfulness. But if you really want to transform yourself, if you really have a kind of internal destination, then we need to kind of be more consistent and disciplined in how we go about it. Because unfortunately, we have been very consistent and persistent in the cultivation of unwholesomeness, of delusion, of being distracted, right? We've worked that we've worked that very diligently. We have been very devoted practices. I mean, we have been very devoted to it sounds bizarre, but we've even been very devoted to cultivating misery for ourselves, right? That if we often look, we obsessively ruminate on stories and mind states over and over again that only produce unhappiness for ourselves and only make it more difficult to be happy in life and to really relate in a wholesome way to others. Again, we over and over, we consistently practice delusion, so to speak. We practice often the path to unhappiness, the practice of unhappiness. And we need to acknowledge that and acknowledge that's where I'm beginning. Right? I obsessively ruminate on negative things. Right? Or I don't obsessively, I'm pretty good most of the time, but then something negative happens and I start obsessing over and over, cultivating, worrying, resenting. You know what I'm saying? And so we have to understand that if we can't see when we're doing that, and if we can't name it correctly, and if we can't do something else, that we will not change. So this process is quite wonderful. Now again, you might go, well, what's so wonderful about being down here in the swamp when I'd rather much be up there? Right? And that's a good that's a good question. Right, one could say, knowing, you know, that what's up there is quite wonderful, and knowing I'm in a swamp, isn't that like depressing? Isn't that frustrating? Shouldn't I be overwhelmed with a sense of futility and despair? Right? That this is the potential. And yet, you know, I'm in the swamp. Well, from that point of view, it is pretty depressing. But that's not the way we look at it. That's not the way we look at it. The way we look at it is, when I'm in the swamp and I think this is all that life has to offer me, that's depressing. Right? Is that clear? That's depressing. But knowing that I'm in the swamp and there's a way to get to there, it's a way to get out and to get to where I want to go, that is very uplifting. That creates happiness. In and of itself, that creates joy. Right? So we have to be very careful that at the same time we are, you know, kind of looking in the mirror and being willing to take a very clear view of ourselves and where we're at. At the same time, if there is not that sense of destination and path to destination and support on the way of destination and knowing that this is a tried and true path to my destination, oh, see, that feels good. You see? That feels good. So it's a very important, again, how we, not just the practice, but how we relate to the practice. So again, in the same way, in a very personal way, we sit down to meditate, don't we? And what would we, and what would we hope's going to happen? We're just going to be fully concentrated, let's say this morning, fully concentrated on our breath, right? Right? Not distracted, thoughts will come and go, but I'll just stay fully present and aware, and my mind will really calm and quiet down and be very open, right? Isn't that what we're hoping is going to happen? Unfortunately, it doesn't happen that way for many of us, right? It's just endless thoughts arising. We follow them. We try to push them away. It's almost like it's the opposite of what we want. And we can get what? Frustrated. This is not for me. Or this may be for someone, but my mind's too messed up. I'm screwed up. Right? We can go down that road. Right? Rather than doing the same thing which we talked about, which is, I'm this is my swamp. Everybody here has their own swamp. Some of you may be out of the swamp. You may have, kind of worked your way through the valley a bit, and you're beginning to move up the mountain. So we have a very diverse group here. But it doesn't matter. Because everybody who's working their way up the mountain started out in the swamp. Right? And this has been going on for thousands of years, so don't feel like there's anything new about this. So, every time we sit in our own minds. We sit with our minds the way they are. And again, sometimes you may, the meditation may go well, the concentration may go well. Sometimes it may not, in the same way that throughout our day, sometimes various moods arise and sometimes they don't. Right? And that's just the way it is. That's the weather. This morning, rainy, cloudy weather. Right? Next Sunday, sunny, sunny, hot. Right? So, that's just the way it is. So, in this practice, it's not about trying to control the way things are, it's about how we relate to the way things are. Right? So, we can be as happy and as peaceful on a sunny day as a rainy day. Right? We don't have to be disappointed. We don't have to be frustrated. We don't have to make a drama about the rain and getting wet. We could, couldn't we? But we don't have to, do we? That's the realm of choice. Right. So in the same way, we learn to work with the weather, something we cannot control. In the same way, we need to learn to work with our minds, which in the beginning, we don't have any control over, but we can begin to have control over how we relate to our minds, to this stuff that's constantly arising. Many people have a hard time because what arises in their mind are thoughts that they don't want to have. Right? But the problem is, you have them. Right? And the suffering is coming from you think the suffering is coming from the thoughts, and I would say the suffering is coming from that part of you that doesn't want to have those thoughts and is frustrated, disappointed, hurt. That's the problem. But to sit, with openness and letting whatever arise, arise. Nothing arises, something arise. Good thought, bad thought, worldly thought, spiritual thought, dull thought, whatever arises. Can we just be open to it? And stop identifying with it. This is a very key piece of Dharma. That we stop identifying with this passing parade of thought, feelings, and perceptions, which is beyond our control. There has to be an acknowledgement, this thing is beyond our control. In the same way, when we sit here, we cannot control the noise on Nebraska, can we? No. It could be quiet, it could be noisy. This sound and that sound. We can't control it. If we try to control it, if we go, oh, that's a terrible sound, oh, that's disturbing my meditation, or who are those people, or, you know, then there's disturbance. But the disturbance is coming from where? From me. Not from out there. So in the same way, in understanding like the weather or the sounds or whatever, that we don't have to be disturbed by what's going on around us, if we learn to accept things as they are, in the same way we have a bigger challenge inside us. Because for many of us, we don't want to accept how we are. Do we? We want to be what? Someone else. Who would you like to be? You know, it's like a fantasy game. And many people have their own little fantasy of who they'd like to be. Okay? Now, if you want to play fantasy games and you know they're fantasy games, then it's a game and it's not harmful. But if you're playing fantasy games as if they're real, that could be problematic. We know that one of the things, if we want to cultivate a more loving mind or heart, in Buddhism they're the same, if we want a more loving heart, then we need to learn to love people what? As they are. Anybody ever heard that? It's called unconditional love. We've all learned about that. That's why we love our pets. They give us unconditional love. Right? Human beings, we have a little more problem with. but our pets, you know, it's like they love me unconditionally and I love them unconditionally. Right? I mean, they're just animals. Naked. Selfish times. Often don't have the best hygiene. But we love them. We love them. Right? I mean, we'll even follow them around outside with a little plastic bag and pick up their poop in public. Something we would never do for another human being. And yet we love them. Unconditionally, because we why? Because we accept them as they are. Right? You know, we need to see that this is not just given. There is something we are doing and not doing. Right? We could be out there watching people with their dogs and just having a, you know, running a whole story about foulness of dogs and why don't they blah, 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 and you know, what's wrong with them and can't they learn to control their bladders and it's disgusting, you know, they, wherever they want, they go and, you know, couldn't care less. They even seem to be proud of it and they like to sniff other people, you know what I mean? It's like, right? And if we had that kind of reaction, our minds would be disturbed. They'd be agitated. We'd have afflictive emotions arising in us. Every morning when we went for a walk. But we don't do that, do we? We accept this. So we see the mind has a great capacity for understanding and accepting the way things are. So we need to learn to develop that ability to accept things as they are, not only with the external world, but even more importantly, with the internal world. The internal world of our thoughts, our feelings, our perceptions, our memories. This is just, it is the way it is because of causes and conditions in the past. That is why things are arising. the big deal? If you can see it that way. And in the midst of that, begin to develop this capacity to be mindful, to calm, to relax, to be open, to be spacious, and then to look over time more deeply into what is the source of all this. Why don't we stop for a second? So any questions about this? Just reflect. I mean, does this make sense to you? Can you see yourself doing it? Do you think you couldn't do it? What's your sense of this? Any questions? Yes.
Has it been your experience that the more you are open to whatever is going on inside, whatever thoughts or emotions or whatever, the longer you do that, the less destructive potential it has? Does it lessen in any way, I guess, is what I'm asking.
So the question is, if you do practice this mindful awareness and are more open and objective about what's ever arising, does the effect of these of your stuff become less destructive? Of course. You know, when we talk about the destructive, I would imagine the nature of these mind states, these emotions, these memories that you're talking about, I mean, what is their power to destroy? They have no power, right? I mean, we might say bombs, you know, weapons have power. We can see that, you know, when they are used, destruction occurs, harm occurs, right? But what we're talking about when we talk about these things that are arising in our mind are not like that. They don't have any physicalness, do they? So we talk about their destructiveness only because we don't understand clearly what they're doing. They're just thoughts and feelings and emotions and memories that are arising where? Where are they arising? In our minds and nowhere else. And part of, you know, developing a more inward life, a life where you begin to learn how to look in this direction rather than that direction, is you begin to understand that, right? All these destructive emotions, afflictive emotions, mind states, they're arising in my own mind. Now, how do they get potentized? Yeah, when I grab onto them, when I ruminate, when I obsess, when I struggle with, and when I allow them because I am uncomfortable. Many people act out from their afflictive emotions because they are not capable of holding them in mindfulness. Right? We are uncomfortable with our own suffering. And because we are uncomfortable with our own suffering, we want to discharge it. We want to discharge it. And we usually discharge it on who? Anybody around. And if it's only us around, we discharge it on ourselves. So many people do destructive things, act out destructively, do things that are harmful to themselves. Right? But they also act out and do things that are harm to those around them. Oftentimes, who's around them? This is the bizarre thing. Who's around us most of the time? People we love. I mean, it's so paradoxical, right? That's why we often feel, you know, a lot of regret and shame afterwards, because we've acted out on people we love. But in this mindfulness tradition, what we're learning over time is to be, you know, to be aware, let's say, of these destructive, afflictive emotions, when they're arising in us, so we're not just swept away by them unconsciously, as most of us are done, right? Right? You know, like, see, I got up this morning when I was coming out, I looked up in the sky, and you know what I saw? it look like rain, right? Mindful, right? I looked up. It looked like rain. So you know what I did? I took an umbrella with me, and it's sitting in my office next to my shoes, right? No, this is not PhD stuff. But it shows you that when you are mindful of what's going on around you, you can do something constructive. Okay? If you're not, you know, we'll get, it's like, you know, where'd that rain come from? It's like a lot of, that's the way many of us, we're stumbling around in life. We can't quite figure out. It was like, it was just sunny yesterday. It's a rainy thing, you know, something. Right? We're just, okay, we're not aware. We don't accept that things are changing and we're present. So first we can be learned. First we got to develop mindfulness. You know, can I just be with my body breath? Not perfectly, but that I have some awareness of myself, of my body, my breath. It's easier. Mind is much trickier, right? Much more elusive. And we identify much more with the stuff that goes on inside it. So we begin with our body breath. It's a good, solid ground. And it really has no emotion in it. You know, it's just sensations. There's no emotion in it. Right? And then in turn, we learn to turn that mindfulness to our mind, the thoughts, feelings, perceptions that arise in it. And so we become aware when these destructive mind states are arising in me. Okay? Now, you know, then at that point, there are various things that one can do, depending on the maturity of one's practice. Right? But the important thing is, in terms of what I was just saying, is to learn to hold an afflictive mind state. See, that's very important. Because again, as I said, it's our inability to be present to our own afflictive mind state which often then precedes our acting out, our moving about, or trying to get rid of it. Right? See, so we distract ourselves. You know, we either distract ourselves or we numb ourselves or we act out. You know what I mean? There are lots of ways that we try to work with our uncomfortable emotions. All of them, unfortunately, unhealthy. But the bottom line is, what are they? You know, what is my anger? What is my resentment? What are my memories? You know, what is my sadness? What is my pain? What is my hurt? What is my fear? Everybody know what I'm talking about? This is the full range of, they're just emotions that are arising where? In my mind. That's all. And if I can learn to see them as they are and to relate to them in a healthy way, right? Then, you know, just like, you know, how do I relate to a stormy day? You know, put on my rain slicker and get my umbrella, get on my waders, you know, whatever it is, right? But there's no emotion in it, you know, because I know how to deal with it, right? And so we want to develop our mindfulness and our concentration, our insight to the point that we can at least, be present to ourselves and to be able to hold whatever is arising in our mind in mindfulness, with understanding, with compassion. And we can learn, if we learn to hold our emotions and our mind states within us before acting out, right? We can then learn that we can turn the same things we need to learn to turn to the external world, right? To be more understanding, more accepting, more loving, more compassion, more patience, right? All those qualities we're developing for the external world, we develop them for the internal world, right? So now, when we are aware that there is suffering inside us, and we can hold it in mindfulness and awareness, Now we have the capacity of turning our capacity to understand, to have insight, our capacity to be kind and to want to relieve our suffering on ourselves. And then there's less need to act out. Again, act out toward other human beings, or act out in these kind of destructive or meaningless ways that we use because we're not comfortable being who we are. Remember, where are we? Each of us we begin in our own swamp. Everybody here has their own swamp. Okay? That's all. And we need to learn how to be swamp dwellers. I mean, I would imagine there are people who learn to live in the swamp. Right? Right? I mean, you know, the poor Native Americans who, you know, that are called the Seminoles that were driven, you know, out of other parts of the South and had to take refuge deep in the Everglades swamp, uninhabitable land. You know, they developed a culture. They developed the skills to survive in the swamp and to maintain their culture. Quite wonderful. In the swamp. Right? No air conditioning. So it's like that, you know, we need to learn how to be healthy dwellers within our own minds, whatever they are. If you are blessed with a fairly calm and stable and happy mind because of your causing conditions, that's wonderful. But if you have not been blessed with that, and because of causes and conditions, there's a lot of afflictive emotions, a lot of worry, a lot of anxiety, a lot of sadness, a lot of resentment, anger, hurt, you know, all that, you know, we need to learn that that's what we need to relate to. Stop running away from it, stop numbing it, stop doing all those other kinds of things, but we need to learn to turn, to relate, transform. Heal and transform. You know, traditionally Buddhism is called a path to awakening, path to enlightenment, which it definitely is. But, you know, Thich Nhat Hanh, who's very modern, you know, he calls it the path of healing and transformation, which again, I think speaks to our modern condition. That many of us, before we can transform, we need to heal. And many of us have a lot of a woundedness within us. We still are functioning with, you know, some broken bones that haven't healed. And so before we can really begin this journey of transformation, we need to do some healing. Make sense? Yeah, of course. So that's why it's called, he calls it the path of healing and transformation. It's the same path to enlightenment, but has a different connotation because it acknowledges that for whatever reason in this day and age, the emotional suffering for many people is very deep and needs to be addressed. We can't skip over it. Other questions about what we're saying? Yes. Say that again? Yeah. Good question. It's just interesting, you know, we have these intensives in our community, and I'm meeting with the people in the intensive, some of the intensives after this, later, and one of the intensives is on love. So, but let me just say a few words. So the question is, how does one develop unconditional love for oneself? I think it's important that, I think it's always easier to do something if we kind of know it, right? So that's why, I mean, you know, many, many years ago when I started teaching or even as a therapist and would talk about love and unconditional love or people, I realized that oftentimes I was dealing with people who said the words but really never had had the felt experience. Right? So the first thing is, what is your name? What?
Monica.
Yes, Monica. So I'd say to you, have you ever felt that somebody was relating to you in this unconditional way, or even that you have related to anyone else in this unconditional way? And I include animals too, and pets. Have you ever felt that? Either coming toward you, that somebody loved you just the way you are, or you felt that for another person, or a baby, or a pet. I should put my glasses on. It seems to be your... Oh, there you are, okay. You say you have. Okay. What was that like? Just think about either... So have you been the recipient of that ever? From another person?
Well, I babysit kids, and I see how they love themselves.
You what? You work with children?
Yes.
Okay, but you were a child. Remember? Did you ever feel that anybody loved you? Just as you were. It's hard to remember. Yeah. Most people loved you kind of conditionally. That you didn't feel it was like a sun that always shone. It was more like a sun that only showed at times, and other times it didn't shine on you. Other people's love for you. Is that what you're experiencing? Depends. How about you toward others, like a child or an animal? Have you ever felt this kind of unconditional love toward someone? Toward children, good. See, that's important to understand. So in the presence of children, you have this unconditional love. So what does that mean? Because I hate to tell you, Monica, there are some people who hate children. Did you know that? Just can't stand it. Like, what kind of children do you work with?
Two-year-old.
Some people go like... I mean, I know people who are even parents who can't wait for their kids to grow up so they can relate to them in a different way. So please understand the fact that you, right, unconditionally love two-year-olds is something about you, okay? So other people find two-year-olds talk to most parents of two-year-olds, okay? But you, all their behaviors, right? All their acting outs, all their little petty little this and that. I mean, two-year-olds are pretty petty, aren't they? I mean, the things that they get upset about, right? Would you agree? The things they get angry about, and right, throw temper tantrums about. I mean, they're fairly petty, and they're not too intelligent. Have you noticed that? Right? I mean, they're let them alone and they'll make endlessly wrong choices. And they're often not too kind to one another, right? They don't like to share, do they? What? Some of them do, but many of them don't, right? So, and yet you accept them unconditionally, right? Right? You love them unconditionally, you say. Accept them. How do you do that? I mean, they drive other people up a wall. How do you do that?
You watch them.
But I would say you watch them, but you also accept them as they are. Right? So whenever they do all this stupid stuff they do, you think it's cute. Why? Because they're two-year-olds, right? If a 15-year-old was doing the same stuff, I don't think you'd be going, oh, they're so adorable, would you? Okay, can you see it? So we have to understand that love You know, Thich Nhat Hanh said, when I first heard him say this many years ago, he said, love is not a feeling, love is understanding. When you understand someone, that's really loving them, right? So you understand those two-year-olds are two years old, right? You understand how they are and how their minds work, and you just accept them as they are and just work with them, right? You don't get angry. You don't get despairing. You don't put them down. You're not disappointed that they're not more mature. Right? Right? You see? Because you understand them. And therefore you can relate to them in this totally open and positive way. Is that true? Okay. So I want to say to you, Monica, that's an example in that very little narrow range of two-year-olds of unconditional love. You know how to do it. The question is, why do I just only shine it on two-year-olds? What if I shone that same way to myself and to everyone else? So in Buddhism, the practice of unconditional love is something we practice. It's not like it's given. It actually is given, but we have screwed it up because of all the conditions we put. You know, we treat our love as if it's what? Something very special. And I'm only going to give it to a few people. Right? They have to earn it. Right? Do you see? They have to earn it, don't they? I'm very discriminating. Right? I just give my unconditional love to very few people who meet this criteria. Right? Can you see how we set it up? Right? So it seems like whatever criteria you have for adults and teenagers, you don't have for two-year-olds, do you? That's wonderful, you see. And what I'd say to you is you can begin with your unconditional love that you've experienced with two-year-olds, and you can learn to open that up. Right? Just open that up. Three-year-olds, four-year-olds, five-year-olds. Can you see? 7, 8. Whew. Then you get to the 12, 15-year-olds. That'll be a real challenge. But as someone who's raised children, I can tell you can do it. Right? It just pulls forth more understanding, more unconditional love, okay? But that's good. How can we grow in our capacity to love if we're not challenged? Does that make sense to you, Monica? So that's how you do it. You begin somewhere. I've often worked with people who can't find it in the human realm. I said, have you found it with a pet? You know? Your dog, your cat, your canary. You know, your pet salamander. I'll take anything I can get. Right? You see? I mean, there probably are some people, unfortunately, in this world who have been so damaged by life that they've never experienced it. And that's sad, because that makes it very difficult for them to learn how to love if that seed of love has never been, ever, ever, ever been touched. Right? I mean, that's the sadness of some of the world we live in. But I think for most people, at some point along the way, it was touched. Right? I mean, traditionally, in the Buddhist teaching, when we're talking about the tradition of cultivating love, traditionally, the most common source of that would be one's mother. And I know a lot of people could be wincing, because a lot of us have a different kind of mental formation about mothers or mothering. But traditionally, the idea that there was this human being who went through 9 months of suffering, difficulty, uncomfortableness, right? For me, right? For me. You know, endured all that for me. Anybody here ever been present at a birth? Their own or somebody else's? Is it like a, you know, unless you're taking drugs, is it a pain-free experience? No, very painful, very difficult. Yeah. You know, our mothers went through that for us. And even if over time they weren't the best of mothers, they did keep us alive, maybe, right? They did make sure we were fed and kept safe. And if we were uncomfortable, they, you know, checked on us, changed our diapers, you know. When we were infants, we were probably not the most stable creatures. You know, we'd be up in all hours of the night, demanding to be fed, demanding to be changed, demanding to be held. You know, and oftentimes it was our mother, these days could be our father, who was there for us. Right? So, in this way, we reflect, you see, about what unconditional love may look like in this life. And we realize it's not so far away from us, right? We often talk about unconditional love like it's this extraordinary thing, right? May I one day be so developed, almost on the verge of full Buddhahood, that I can offer love to other human beings. But it's not like that. We can begin now. But how do we do it? As a practice. And slowly we work out. We reflect like this. And especially we might reflect, I mean, it is a positive thing that we can offer beings, but it's also something that we can be aware of when we're struggling. Right? We're struggling to like ourselves or love ourselves, so to speak. We're struggling to love or like this other person in our life. Right? And are we willing to step back and see, you know, what is it? Why the struggle? What am I holding on to? What is it that I don't want to accept? What is it that I don't want to open to in myself or this other person or this situation? You see, that's always what it's about. Because unconditional love is something that arises where? In me, see, right? It's an attribute of my heart mind. It's not conditional on other people. Are all the 2-year-olds in your world the same? Never. Are some easier to love and like than others? What? All of them. But sometimes do some try your patience a little more than others? Oh yeah, okay, that's what I'm all right. What do? How do you overcome that? So you don't get negative toward one of the kids or Ah, Monica, you know what that's called? You must have been studying Buddhism. You know what that's called? That's called understanding. You see, you have understanding, don't you? Right? So even then when you see them acting out or misbehaving or doing it, you think to yourself, oh, they're the product of their causes and conditions. Right? Now, do you do that with all the adults in your life? Why do you laugh, Monica? Yeah, why do you laugh when I asked you that? Do you do that with all the adults in your life? Yeah, why not? Aren't they the same? Aren't they all the product of their causes and conditions? Gee, who have you been hanging out with? That's your experience in life, that all the adults you hang out with are mature, self-realized, emotionally together beings? Is that your experience in life? That's the way adults are. Hold on. See, I'm not talking about fantasy. Monica, I'm asking you, okay? So one thing about Buddhist psychology, it's grounded in reality, okay? So I'm asking you a real life question. All right, you ready for this? Monica, how old are you? All right, Monica, and you're 23 years of age, right? And is that your experience that pretty much all the adults, or at least most of the adults you know, are very mature, emotionally stable, grown up? For those who can't see, Monica's going like this. So your idea about how they should be, how they ought to be, is just some idea you have that you're imposing on them, isn't it? Again, if you went to your two-year-old with the same mind state, that they should be different than they are, would you be very loving and open to them? No. So, again, we should notice that with two-year-olds, you're willing to practice understanding. But with 22-year-olds, you cut it off at 3, right? Do you see what we do? And that is a cognitive, that's a perceptual thing we do. It's not in reality that somehow, you know, we're only understanding up to 3. After that, no more understanding for people. They have to be the way we expect them to be. But Monica, people are as they are. And even people who are 23 or 43 or 63 or 83 are a product of their causes and conditions. As is Monica. Right? You see? And when you can learn to shine the light of understanding on Monica in the same way you do on two-year-olds, and you can shine it on 22-year-olds and 42-year-olds, then your relationship to life changes. Right? So when you go to work and you work with your 2-year-olds, are you miserable every day? You're not. Why not? That you generate toward them and comes back. It's kind of a neat thing, isn't it? You think it'd be possible to relate to adults in the same way? Yeah, that would be interesting. How would life be then? If you started enjoying them with all their stuff. Now, I grant you, since I have young grandchildren, that there is something sweeter, fresher, endearing about the stuff of a 2-year-old. Than the stuff of a 42-year-old. I would grant you that, right? But we can get over that one, right? And begin to see them with fresh eyes, that they're just a product of their causing conditions. And if we come to them in that way, right? The same way when you come to those 2-year-olds with happiness, with caring, with acceptance, I would imagine that brings a certain response out of them. That if somebody came with a much heavier kind of mind state, you know, they may not get. So if you start coming into life and other adults with that same kind of mind state you take to work, it might be interesting how your relationships begin to change. Does that make sense to you? Yeah, so your question was, how does one generate unconditional love to oneself? Do you sort of have a little inkling now? Good. Thank you. Any more questions? Yes.
Good morning. My name is Gina. When you were talking earlier, you talked about, I seem to have heard you say that thoughts have no power, that it's just a thought. And you also said these thoughts, when you react from them, you can use the term act out. And if you don't want to do that, you have to, I guess what I heard you say is allow the thought to come in and and then you get your hand like this, like you're turning it. And then you're going to be mindful, okay, so I'm missing a step.
Yeah, well, I mean, let me just say, talking about it and doing it are two different things.
Sure it is, sir.
It, well, this, yeah, so the question is, this whole idea of these emotions, or they're just things that are rising in the mind, and one can sort of just see them as having no substance or having no power and just let them be. You're asking, you know, what, you're asking, like, how do you do that?
Well, when you did your hand, you literally just turned your hand.
Oh. You'll have to ask my hand about that one. I mean, I
just let it be.
Yeah.
Oh.
Really, is that the way it looks? Okay. See, I'm up here. I can't see myself, you see, so I don't know how it looks. Yeah, so good. Well, I'm not sure. So what that means is we need to turn our mind, right? Which again, if for many people who don't have experience in meditation or mindfulness, this may be hard to understand, because we're talking about a terrain that most of us are unfamiliar with. But I assure you that if you begin to develop a more inward life and a more meditative life and mindfulness life, you will understand clearly what we're talking about. Most of us have never watched our minds. I mean, for many people, the idea of watching your mind, watching your thoughts arise and pass, watching emotions arise and pass, right, is like, what is he talking about? Okay? I am describing an internal process. Most of us, unfortunately, in our life, we have always been externally oriented. We are experts on the world, and we're experts on everybody else in the world, right? Because we watch them. But we are often incompetent or ignorant of watching our own minds, which is the source of all our emotionality. It is not arising out there. It's arising in here. And when I point in here, I'm pointing to this thing we call our, for want of a better thing, we call our mind. Okay? It's arising in our mind. Now, at this point, we don't even know that. Right? We often know we are angry because we what? What? Because we're acting out. Wow, I'm really angry. But that whole process of how what began as a thought began to kind of gather steam within my mind and attach itself to other thoughts and begin to repeat and begin to generate kind of a physiological arousal in my body, we are blind to that. We don't know that. We just know we're angry when it kind of explodes out. Okay? So what I'm talking about is the capacity. It's not that difficult, but it does take this. Maybe that's what I can't speak for the hand, but maybe that's what it, you know what I'm saying? But maybe that's what that's about. It's saying we need to turn in this direction. And for many of us, you know, it's even hard to get our neck around. You know what I mean? It's like, what? Yeah, it's like, you know, yeah, there's something going on back there. You see, it's like if I was sitting up here talking to you this way, and there were like 25 people behind me making all kinds of hand motions, and right? I wouldn't see it, would I? And you could be laughing, and you could be angry, you could be all kinds of things. And I don't know why you are, because it's, I can't see that back there. You see?
Are you saying that's your mind?
Yeah, I'm saying it's all going on in your mind. Thoughts, feelings, perceptions, memories, it's all going on in our mind. Where else could it be going on? I mean, do you know what's going on in your neighbor's mind?
No.
No. I mean, we could go around the room. We don't know what's going on in anybody else's mind. Right? We think we do. We act as if we do. But the truth is we don't. Right? And the scary truth is we don't even know what's going on in our own mind. And yet we think we have the answer to everybody else's mind. Oh, I know what's going on with her. Right? You see what I'm saying? You know, that's where we're experts. But in terms of our own mind. So that's what this is about. Right? It's about a recognition that much of my life, all the filters, all the projections, all the emotions, all the memories, all these things are arising where? In my mind. And meditation is that process whereby I learn how to relate directly to my mind to heal and transform it. Okay, so that's...
So by healing and transform, you're saying you take the energy out of the acting out?
Yes, definitely. Yeah, over time, no more acting out. Because why? Because the cause of it has been transformed. Right? Now we act out because we don't see. Right? What's going on? So we're always being ambushed, right? And we find ourselves in this mind state or that mind state, or we find ourselves saying or doing things, and it's often like, you know, how did I get here? But, you know, there is a process that brought us here. We're just not aware of it. So when we talk about meditation and becoming more mindful or aware, we're talking about now we become aware. When we become aware, we don't have the capacity to change. But without that self-awareness, that mindfulness, it's very difficult to change because we don't know what it is to change.
Okay, so what I'm hearing from you is the step I'm missing is awareness.
Yeah, which is what the meditative path is about. It's that technology that allows us to turn, when I point to this direction, I'm not pointing to this body, I'm pointing to the mind that most of us perceive as being in here. Maybe not quite even be like that, but that's the way we see it. Thank you for your question. So, thank you.